There we go, and you can hit that to pause.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
I am interviewing. My name is Jan. I'm age 65 years old. Today's date is February the 1st, and I'm speaking with Lisa, who is my friend. We are recording this interview in San Jose, California. Lisa, the first question I have for you is, what is the purpose?
So, a little bit about myself. As Jan said, my name is Lisa, and I live in South San Jose. I'm a 51-year-old African-American woman. Right now, I am volunteering at the Santa Clara County chapter of the National Alliance of Mental Illness, also known as NAMI, and I am a presenter where I talk to audiences about my mental health challenges. I've spoken to inpatient clients in psychiatric hospitals, at community colleges, as well as universities. I am also working on my autobiography, and I'd like to get it published. I would also like to have my story on the big screen. I am also a parent to a 3-year-old female Chihuahua mix named Bear that I adore. I am also a survivor of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse, as well as neglect.
So, Lisa, what is the purpose in sharing your story?
My hope is that those lives who have been touched by any kind of an abuse and neglect as children to feel as if I am embracing those affected people in a safe, warm hug as I share my story as a survivor. On that note, let me start off by saying that for several decades, if someone whom I knew and trusted came up and hugged me, I couldn't feel their embrace. And maybe I just didn't at the time allow myself to feel something that should feel good, a hug. What's interesting is that many of these people would often remark about how wonderful my hugs are. It wasn't until at the age of 49 years old that I actually allowed myself to feel a trusted friend's embrace and hug. For me personally, I have my own definition of the difference between me being a victim versus being a survivor. For a huge chunk of my life, I saw myself as a victim, being that I allowed myself to be attached to a narrative in which I was just as complicit as my abusers in allowing the abuse to continue. I seemed to be addicted to a victim narrative that I felt kept me from taking responsibility for the role I played in furthering that narrative, such as not standing up for myself and letting people know immediately when they were clearly violating my boundaries. In a sense, for me, feeling helpless, as if I had no choice in redefining that victim narrative, turning it around and seeing that I do have it within me to let others know whenever something they do is not in alignment with my values and our boundaries. It certainly wasn't something that happened overnight. I was sick and tired of my part in allowing people to basically quote-unquote shit on me, whether it be family and or friends. I was also tired of participating and perpetuating an abuse narrative with friends whom seemed to see themselves as helpless and powerless as I had felt in seeing myself as a victim. I no longer wanted to be part of those relationships because I truly felt as if I were actually enabling them as well as being part of their problem and continuing the cycle of abuse. So I decided with a heavy heart to let go of those relationships. I knew that those people weren't ready to let go of what I defined for myself personally as a victim narrative. As of now, at 51 years of age, I define myself as a survivor of emotional, physical, and sexual abuse as well as neglect. In my eyes, a survivor is a person who no longer feels held prisoner by their traumatic past. In essence, my brutal past is not who I am as a person, it is just a part of me. I have also begun to set boundaries with people, whether it be family or friends, as well as others I come into contact with. Just as with the Me Too movement, no means no. It wasn't easy, but as I began to find my voice, as well as stand up for myself, I felt so empowered. I have also gleaned power from discovering that I myself have always had the answers in terms of healing from the trauma, that no one can manipulate me and walk all over me unless I allow them to. The emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, as well as neglect, started not long after I came out of my mother's womb. What I'd like my fellow survivors to tell their child within is that they are precious, innocent, that what happened to them wasn't normal, that they have every right to be angry, even now as adults, about what happened to them, that everyone heals individually, and to respect where you are in your healing. Don't let anyone bully you into believing that their way is the correct way to heal. Don't allow anyone to tell you to just let go, move on, and forgive those who ravaged your body as a child if you truly don't believe that to be so. I myself fell into that trap, allowing others to tell me and or demand the proper way to heal from trauma and neglect is their way. Not only didn't this approach work for me, but it left me angry, frustrated, invalidated, as well as made me feel as if I was somehow deficient since I couldn't heed these bullies' advice and or get over my traumatic past. Looking back, I can clearly see that these people weren't my friends. If they truly were my friends, then they would respect however I chose to heal. Still another reason for me bringing this interview to fruition is that I like to share with people, especially survivors, what I learned along the way towards healing, what helped and what didn't as I grappled with my horrendous past. I certainly don't have all the answers, but I do truly believe that in sharing our stories of trauma and neglect as children, we silence our abusers, find our voice, grow stronger, and we don't feel so alone. That everyone heals individually and to respect where you are in your healing. What has always baffled me and seems to be quite common is that many mothers whom are aware of their own child's abuse, especially if it's at the hands of their own husband, do nothing and just ignore it, basically putting their head in the sand. So in that sense, I felt alone, as far as neither of my parents doing anything until much later in terms of getting me some professional help. And then by that time, so much damage had been done to me, especially in terms of my mental health. It was also equally confusing, being that both parents were social workers. For me, seeing my mother do nothing, in effect being complicit in allowing her husband and others to continue to abuse me throughout my childhood, never protecting me and or helping me feel safe, really devastated me and affected my relationships, especially with other females. I deeply felt a void inside of me. I was hungry for someone, another female, be it a friend and a therapist, to take care of me and love me. I'd become intensely attached to these people and demand their full attention. I felt as if I were just roaming around aimlessly trying to find a mother figure. The most difficult part was not only didn't I understand the depth of this intense need, but I also never knew how to feel it inside me. But it clearly scared those with whom I was so attached. Some assumed I was lesbian because of this behavior. One person threatened me with calling the police. I hold no ill will towards these people because it certainly wasn't their job to fill me up. Something I want to follow up on is the fact that I never truly was alone. However, I kept my pain and tears from my family, starting at 5 years old. Fortunately, I did have my Siamese cat Bambi that kept me company, who was with me most of my time from an early age, maybe not much longer after I was born, up until one morning when I was in seventh grade, and when I went out to get Bambi from the garage, I found her lifeless body on the floor. Oh, how I miss Bambi. That was my first experience with a loss. No one comforted me. I came to expect no kind of emotional support from either parent. I believe another reason for my mother just looking the other way and her being neglectful as well as complicit in allowing her husband to abuse me as well as others was the fact that I did well academically. At least I had my mother's attention whenever I excelled academically, as well as in my creative endeavors, playing the violin for 13 years, playing the San Jose Youth Symphony, and winning many awards, as well as Best of Show a few times for my artwork, and having a one-woman art show at 10 years old, of which I have no recollection. I do recall having quite a collection of artwork, and in many ways, my art endeavors were an outlet for me, but only for a while. when it became too painful to create art. Back to my original point, I know that throughout my life, even when I was quite young, I did have people whom were very good friends, were there for me, validated me, listened to me, as well as at times gently encouraged me to take care of myself. I call those wonderful people my angels. Even if these angels were only in my life for a short period, I really appreciated whatever they did to make my life feel a little richer and fulfilling. One of the persons who stands out the most to me, whom I consider an angel, was a guy named Don, whom I happened to get to know while he worked the graveyard shift at a grocery store that wasn't far from my home. At that time, I wasn't stable, wasn't sleeping, was underweight, was restricting my food intake and or starving myself, as well as over-exercising. The grocery store was part of the route I chose as I engaged in rigorous exercise at 3 a.m. in the morning, every day of the week, regardless of injury, fatigue, illness, or the weather. Sometimes I would hallucinate seeing things that weren't really there. So I began always stopping by the grocery store and talking with Don for a bit. Don was a stocky guy who was also Samoan, bald, and about 5'7". At the time, I was 5'2" and under 90 pounds. We made quite a pair. We looked like Mutt and Jeff. I learned that Don had kids, a new granddaughter that he absolutely adored, that he had lost his first girlfriend to kidney failure, and then he had a new girlfriend whom he seemed quite proud of and was also studying to be a nurse. Don and I seemed to share both the love of football and basketball. In fact, Don told me that he used to return kicks as a football player in high school. I believe, looking back, that Don sensed that I wasn't quite in my right frame of mind, but that never got in the way of the fast friendship we struck up. I even invited Don and his girlfriend to my graduation from San Jose State University in 2014 at 47 years old with a BA in broadcast journalism. Finally graduating from college was quite special for me because I never thought it was possible. Both Don and his girlfriend attended my graduation. For someone like Don to actually take an interest in me while doing his job, as well as gently encourage me to do what I can to be more stable, was priceless. Don was one of many angels along the way and was part of my journey. I've been so blessed to have had angels, never ever being alone.
How did the trauma affect you?
Due to a large part of my environment as well as genetics, I developed anorexia, borderline personality disorder, also known as BPD, bipolar disorder, anxiety, and PTSD. I want to emphasize that my diagnoses don't define the breadth and depth of who I am. Rather, they are just a small part of me. I believe as early as 4 years old, I had the beginnings of BPD. I vividly recall being 4 years old and one day watching my best friend, Tim, and his mother pulling away in their car, which would be the very last time I would ever lay eyes upon Tim. I literally felt as if someone had kicked me in the gut with military boots. That was the very first time I intensely felt abandoned. I would never ever forget that fateful day. One of the prominent symptoms of borderline personality disorder are abandonment issues. It certainly wouldn't be the last time I would feel abandoned by someone. The sexual and physical abuse, as well as neglect on my mother's part, began after I had started to walk, but then regressed to crawling, as told by my mother decades later. My mother told me that as I regressed to crawling, I dragged my right leg, which had a huge bump on my upper right thigh. According to my mother, she had been taking me multiple times to the doctor regarding the bump on my thigh, but kept being told not to worry. Somehow a surgeon happened to examine the affected area upon my upper right thigh and told my mother that it was a hematoma that needed to be surgically removed immediately. Also, the surgeon gave my mother a warning, telling her if he saw any more signs of abuse on me, he'd report her to the police. Apparently, the manner in which I developed the hematoma was by someone repeatedly hitting me over and over in the affected area. Today, I still have a small, tiny scar on my upper right thigh. As far as I know, my mother didn't hurt me physically. I also know that after I was born, my mother eventually returned to work, leaving me with a family friend who babysat me. The next wave of abuse occurred not much longer after we moved into our bigger home, our second home, and I also turned 5 years old. Also at that time, my father began to emotionally abuse me. I was also, at 5 years old, anally raped by my then babysitter 8-year-old brother in my own bathroom. After the rape, I remember lying on my stomach on the floor of the bathroom for a long time, my eyes fixated on the blue tile until I was sure my abuser had left. I remember going downstairs to tell the babysitter what happened. I vividly recall shaking so badly as I struggled to get the words out. I never did find it within myself to tell the babysitter that her 8-year-old brother had anally raped me. I also recall being in my early 30s, attending San Jose State, and going to a restaurant not far from campus. I ordered fries to go. As I waited for my order, I decided to use the bathroom. As I walked towards the bathroom, I noticed a group of 8 to 10 young black men who weren't far from the bathroom. After I did my business, when I tried to open the bathroom door, I couldn't open it. Immediately, fear coursed through my veins as I knocked on the door for literally 10 minutes. Mind you, those young men were very close to the bathroom door, and I'm quite sure they heard me knocking on the door. Eventually, the owner of the restaurant, whom I had noticed was on the other side of the restaurant when I had ordered my fries, came and opened the door to let me out. As I passed those young men, one of them remarked, "You okay, little mama?" I couldn't believe my ears. By those young black men not getting up and opening the bathroom door, it felt like being raped all over in a bathroom, as had occurred when I was 5 years old. What really stung was the fact that these young men were black, as well as my abusers. It just reinforced for me personally that black males couldn't be trusted. The more I thought about that incident, I desperately wanted to reclaim my power and let those young men know how angry I was, as well as let them know I wasn't going to allow their mean-spirited behavior to render me speechless. So I approached and asked the editor of San Jose State Student Paper, the Spartan Daily, if I could write an article about what happened to me at the restaurant so I could feel empowered. I was so sick and tired of being targeted throughout my childhood as well as adulthood by black males and being abused and violated sexually. I recall when I was a sophomore attending a predominantly black college in 1987, I was walking across the floor in a huge downtown building in Atlanta, Georgia, and talking with a friend. As my friend and I passed two older black men, one of the black men put his finger up my butt. It happened so quickly, and it was broad daylight. I also want to emphasize that I wasn't wearing anything suggestive. In fact, I was wearing slacks and a jacket over my top. I was shocked as well as re-traumatized. I recall asking my friend if she saw what happened, but my friend said nothing. Anyways, I did write the article that was published in the Spartan Daily about getting locked in the bathroom of the restaurant and the fact that those young black men did nothing to help me, as well as a little background of my childhood abuse and emphasizing how much it had re-traumatized me. I ended the article asking, did I deserve this? I also showed that article to my father, feeling quite proud of myself as well as empowered, using the pen to be my voice. However, the response I got from my father was, why did you do that? I should have known my father wouldn't support me and approve of the article. What's interesting is a day or two later, after the article had been published in the Spartan Daily, my former African-American studies professor, Dr. Stevens, somehow found me while I was on campus. He told me he had read the article, and he assured me that if he had been around those young black men who never bothered to open the bathroom door of the restaurant for me, that he would have given them an earful. It was very kind and beautiful of Dr. Stevens, who was also African-American, to let me know that he supported me and didn't condone the way those young men had treated me. Not only did Dr. Stevens validate my experience, but he actually gave a damn about me as a person, something my own father wasn't capable of. Having such a positive and kind older black role model, such as Dr. Stevens, helped me see that not all black men are abusive, as well as enforced to me that there are and have always been people, such as Dr. Stevens, whom I call angels, along my journey. In regards to what happened after I'd been anally raped in my own bathroom by the 8-year-old monster, I learned that my... I learned eventually, I learned that I eventually told my mother what had happened, but that only came about after my mother had taken both me and my younger sister to see our pediatrician for our physicals. Apparently, this pediatrician had told both me and my sister about safe and non-safe touches, which according to my mother prompted me to speak up, telling my mother about being anally raped by the babysitter's 8-year-old brother as we drove home. But as usual, my mother's typical behavior of doing nothing in terms of getting me any kind of professional help at 5 years old, after my body had been violated, continued. No one ever asked me how I felt. This continuous non-action on my mother's part just reinforced to me that I didn't matter. As far as I know, my parents promised the parents of the 8-year-old monster who raped me anally that they wouldn't press charges and or call the police as long as the parents got the monster professional help. I don't have much memory of my father sexually abusing me. All I recall was being 5 years old, it was night, and I was in bed. I heard my father come into my room. I closed my eyes and pretended to be asleep. I also had a bunch of blankets between my legs. My father took the blankets between my legs, leaving me naked from the waist down. Only last year, 2018, not much longer after Thanksgiving, I had a nightmare in our memory. My father was on top of me, and I couldn't get him off of me. Immediately, I woke up, scared to go back to sleep. When I was 8 years old, my ex-friend's grandfather, whom was known to the family to be a pedophile, fondled my breasts, kissed me, as well as forced me to have oral sex. I remember his drunken laugh as he touched me inappropriately. Again, nothing was done by my parents to help me feel safe once they were aware of what happened. And, to add insult to injury, the family of this pedophile went out of their way to attack my personhood and character, saying I made up the abuse and her by verbally harassing as well as threatening me. It was so obvious to me that this family was in denial of their sick family member, as well as having a hard time believing their pedophile grandfather was capable of sexually abusing an 8-year-old girl. I wonder how many other children this pervert violated. My very presence seemed to threaten this family, as well as a reminder of their evil, beloved grandfather. As my symptoms of depression, deep fears of abandonment grew, my anxiety and hypervigilance increased to unbearable levels. I wasn't quite yet 10 years old. At 8 years old, I lived intensely, felt intensely, was never able to relax and or sleep soundly. The amount of abuse I had endured early on and continued had reached a crescendo. I couldn't pump the brakes. I vividly recall my intense play with dolls at 5 to 8 years old. I'd close the door of the room I played in so nobody saw my play, something that was a huge source of shame for me. I would always play out a specific scenario with my dolls, over and over, multiple times each day. It felt like a compulsion that seemed to take me over. I'd have one doll representing the mother and another doll representing the baby. In my young, tortured mind, the mommy doll would exact severe torture upon the baby doll, with me often burning the baby doll with matches, cutting the hair off of the baby doll, just doing anything cruel to the baby doll for having baby needs, such as crying for the mommy doll's attention. And then it would end with the mommy doll being very loving towards the baby doll. And then I repeat it over and over again. It's almost as if I had a twisted sense of pain and love being intertwined. And maybe that was my way, at 5 to 8 years old, of reliving and or coping with all the abuse that occurred so early in my life. In addition, my father's continuous emotionally abusive jabs toward me left me feeling like an abused dog with its tail tucked between its legs, full of sheer terror as well as intense fear. I hated my father. I never understood why he targeted me with his rage. My stomach would always be queasy whenever I heard his loud footsteps throughout our house. I was always anxious and terrified of his alcoholic rage, not knowing when it would hit, but always trying to anticipate his brutal rage being directed at me. It was like walking on eggshells, something often attributed to someone who hasn't gotten treatment for borderline personality disorder, which I suspect my father had. In the 7th and 8th grade, I found another outlet, art. Looking back, I vividly recall experiencing, which would eventually be one of my diagnoses, rapid cycling bipolar disorder, as I would spend countless hours up late at night, beyond severely frustrated, because in my eyes, none of my artworks were perfect. For me, rapid cycling would occur when I would experience mixed mood states of dark despair, and at the same time being exuberantly happy and back to deep darkness without any recovery in between. I recall cycling as many as 13 times through mixed mood states within 5 minutes several times throughout the day. I literally felt as if I were coming out of my own skin. The frustration I experienced in never being satisfied with my art pieces was a never-ending irritability, anxiety, high energy, racing thoughts, rapid speech, and severe agitation. This overactivity would lead to anger attacks characterized by impulsivity and explosive outbursts. I soon found myself on the brink of suicide. In fact, that unbearable rapid cycling, along with mixed mood states, led me to make a conscious decision that the last artwork I would ever create, a self-portrait in my sophomore year at Archbishop Mitty High School in 1983, which was heavily influenced by a self-portrait Vincent van Gogh did of himself looking out the window of his room in a psychiatric hospital. Interestingly enough, Vincent van Gogh also suffered from bipolar disorder. That same year, in 1983 at Mitty, my English teacher introduced me to a counselor, Mr. Leroy, suspecting I was suicidal from a paper I turned in. The caring and validation I received from Ms. Leroy, I believe, kept me from losing my mind while in high school. In fact, to this day, since 1983, both Mr. Leroy and I still keep in touch. What I remember in high school, when I was seeing Mr. Leroy, sometimes several times during the week at Mitty, was having permission from all my teachers to leave class if I needed to cry. I would go to the bathroom and cry a lot in the stall alone. However, I have to tell you that my high school years at Mitty were quite rewarding as well as special to me. I had many friends as well as teachers who were very supportive as well as caring. The most important things I learned while being a student at Mitty was that there's no shame in asking for help and never to give up. As I mentioned earlier, I suffered with anorexia. At 10 years old, I was put on a 1,500 calorie diet and prescribed diet pills by my pediatrician. I recall always weighing and measuring my food, as well as making sure I only ate 1,500 calories a day. I was also pretty active, not only at school, but I also swam competitively on a team. Whenever I lost some weight, my mother would reward me by buying a new outfit. However, being on that diet, starting at 10 years old, led me to developing anorexia, which is another way to cope with all the craziness that the trauma and neglect created, an eating disorder that lasted over 40 years. Unfortunately, the anorexia created many medical problems for me, such as irritable bowel syndrome, severe and chronic constipation, having anemia in which I would have to get shots to help my body increase the production of white blood cells, and or having had 2 to 3 bone marrow biopsies, as well as several endoscopies and colonoscopies in my early 30s, well before the required age that adults are supposed to have those procedures. In addition, I was over-exercising, at times running 24 miles a day for a span of 6 weeks straight. I believe the bipolar rapid cycling helped spurn on those long, intense runs. I certainly didn't want to do all that running, but my motor, so to speak, was running. I couldn't sit still or relax. No matter how painful it was in that state, I felt compelled to keep going. When I first began getting mental health treatment, starting in my early 20s, I went through several decades of medication trials, as well as 6 electroconvulsive shock treatments, which offered some antidepressant effects. I was also taking 23 different kinds of medications for both my physical and mental health. However, I was determined to beat the anorexia. Tired of letting my eating disorder control me. The hardest part was me beginning to eat, not restricting and starving myself. For quite some time, I was consuming between 3,000 to 4,000 calories a day. Also, I would often wake up several times during my sleep with intense hunger pains. I'd get up and try to fill myself up with food, desperately trying to subside the hunger pains. The hunger pains were so intense that I often feared I wouldn't wake up the next day. Not only was it scary increasing my caloric intake, but also the weight I was gaining was uncomfortable as well. But I can honestly say that I myself did all the heavy lifting when it came to recovery from anorexia. No eating disorder specialist and her therapist helped me. It's so much sweeter and powerful knowing that I found a way to heal. I am now at a healthy weight, with my weight fluctuating between 133 to 135 pounds. Sometimes I find myself eating more than usual, but I don't panic anymore. When my body tells me it's hungry, I no longer ignore it. I also don't panic if my weight fluctuates. Instead of being my body's worst enemy, I love and embrace my body. The other manner in which I coped, I kind of fell into in my early 20s, when I first tried to commit suicide, as I mentioned earlier, when I was a student at UC Davis. It also took this first suicide attempt for me, my parents, to finally see that I needed professional help, something that should have been done when I was 5 years old, or maybe even earlier. I began cutting on my body, something I began to do in my first suicide attempt. From there on, I would cut on my arms till they look raw from all the cutting. I'd engage as also hitting my hanger with a backside until I had welts and or bled. And I put my fists through windows in my home, as well as many of the art pieces that were in glass frames, with the majority of those art pieces being ruined. The self-harm for me wasn't about being suicidal, rather as a way for me to feel, if only for a few seconds, which led me to cutting often because I'd feel so numb. Many of the therapists I've worked with, and I've had many, terminated treatment with me because I was engaging in self-harm. The self-harm for me was also addictive. I found myself caught up in the self-harm for 26 years. One of the things I especially found helpful, as well as therapeutic in dealing with the self-harm, was me buying a speed bag and setting it up in my garage. Whenever I felt like hurting myself, I would punch the speed bag for 45 minutes to an hour, not only getting a great workout, but also releasing the intense anger I felt, as well as reducing the need to self-harm. No longer do I engage in any kind of self-harm. It's been 1,943 days since I last self-harmed.